Good evening, folks. ULT Bengaluru welcomes you to this evening's talk on the topic, Our Appointed Work in Life. As is customary, we will first begin with a devotional reading of relevant excerpts from theosophical literature, followed by a brief talk to outline key points on the subject, and finally, end with an open-ended discussion. We will take up excerpts from three sources this evening. The first excerpt is from The Light of Asia, Book the Sixth. That fixed decree at silent work, which wills evolve the dark to light, the dead to life, to fullness void, to form the yet unformed, good unto better, better unto best, by wordless edict, having none to bid, none to forbid, for this is past all gods, immutable, unspeakable, supreme, the power which builds, unbuilds, and builds again, ruling all things according to the rule of virtue, which is beauty, truth, and use. So that all things do well which serve the power, and ill which hinder. Nay, the worm does well obedient to its kind. The hawk does well which carries bleeding quarries to its young. The dewdrop and the star shine sisterly, globbing together in the common work. And man, who lives to die and dies to live well, so if he guide his ways by blamelessness and earnest will to hinder not but help all things both great and small which suffer life. The second excerpt we'll consider today is from the Bhagavad Gita, third chapter. We will first consider the verse in Sanskritam and then the translation so as to best capture the beauty and power of these verses. Sahayajna prajasrishtva purovacha prajapati. Anena prasavishyadvam vostvishta kamadhuk. When in ancient times the Lord of creatures had formed mankind and at the same time appointed his worship, he spoke and said, with this worship pray for increase and let it be for you kamadhuk, the cow of plenty, on which ye shall depend for the accomplishment of all your wishes. Devan bhavayata anena, te deva bhavayantu vah, parasparam bhavayanta shreyah paramavapsyatha. With this nourish the gods, that the gods may nourish you. Thus mutually nourishing, ye shall obtain the highest felicity. Ishtan bhogan hi vo deva dasyante yajna bhavita tair dattan apradayebhyo yo bhunte stena eva sah. The gods, being nourished by worship with sacrifice, will grant you the enjoyment of your wishes. He who enjoyeth what hath been given unto him by them and offereth not a portion unto them is even as a thief. Yajna shishta shina santo muchyante sarva kilbishai bhunjate te twagham papam ye pachantyatma karanat. But those who eat not but what is left of the offerings shall be purified of all their transgressions. Those who dress their meat but for themselves eat but the bread of sin, being themselves sin incarnate. Annad bhavanti bhutani parjanyad anna sambhava yajnyad bhavati parjanyo yajnyah karma samudbhava. Beings are nourished by food. Food is produced by rain. Rain comes from sacrifice. Sacrifice is performed by action. Karma brahmat bhavam vidhi brahmaksharam samudbhavam tasmat sarvagatam brahma nityam yajne pratishthitam. Know that action comes from Supreme Spirit, who is one. Therefore, the all-pervading spirit is at all times present in the sacrifice. Evam pravartitam chakram nanuvartayatiha yah aghayurindriya ramo mogham partha sajivati. He who, sinfully delighting in the gratification of his passions, doth not cause this wheel thus already set in motion to continue revolving, liveth in vain, O son of Pritha. Excerpt 3 is from the Voice of the Silence, Fragment 2. Yet, if the doctrine of the heart is too high-winged for thee, if thou needest help thyself and fearest to offer help to others, then thou of timid heart, be warned in time. Remain content with the eye doctrine of the law. Hope still, for if the secret path is unattainable this day, that it is within thy reach tomorrow. Learn that no effort, not the smallest, whether in right or wrong direction, can vanish from the world of causes. Even wasted smoke remains not traceless. A harsh word uttered in past lives is not destroyed, but ever comes again. The pepper plant will not give birth to roses, nor the sweet jasmine silver star to thorn or thistle turn. Thou canst create this day thy chances for thy morrow. In the great journey, causes sown each hour bear each its harvest of effects. For rigid justice rules the world. With mighty sweep of never-erring action, it brings to mortals lives of weal or woe, the karmic progeny of all our former thoughts and deeds. Take then as much as merit hath in store for thee, O thou of patient heart. Be of good cheer and rest content with fate. Such is thy karma, the karma of the cycle of thy births, the destiny of those who, in their pain and sorrow, are born along with thee, rejoice and weep from life to life, chained to thy previous actions. Act thou for them today, and they will act for thee tomorrow. It is from the bud of renunciation of the self that springeth the sweet fruit of final liberation. To perish doomed is he who, out of fear of Mara, refrains from helping man, lest he should act for self. The pilgrim who would cool his weary limbs in running waters, yet dares not plunge for terror of the stream, risks to succumb from heat. Inaction based on selfish fear can bear but evil fruit. The selfish devotee lives to no purpose. The man who does not go through his appointed work in life has lived in vain. The common theme across these three excerpts from disparate sources is the idea that we each come into this earth for a particular purpose, the unfulfillment of which renders that life futile. It is a powerful idea that there is, in fact, a purpose, an appointed work that powerful idea, yet an ominous one. Ominous because the majority of humanity is groping through life with no definite purpose. However, even the more materialistic of us many times stop and question the point of it all. We do it when we're faced with adversities on one end, as well as when we are satiated with pleasure on the other end. But even when things are going swimmingly well in the middle, there is still an unfulfilled yearning to find meaning and a deeper purpose. And as year after year of our short lives roll by, we are gripped with the fear of having lived a meaningless life. The poet of Bhajagovindam opines thus: Balastavat kridasakta, tarunastavat taruni sakta, vriddhastavat chinta sakta, parame brahmani kopina sakta. Meaning, childhood is whittled away by playfulness. Youth whittled away on women, old age whittled away with worry. Nobody is drawn to the supreme Brahman. It is said that the soul departs in great disappointment upon death of its personality that has lived to no purpose. Yet, the merciful law of karma offers opportunities again and again, if we can only seize upon this all-important question and strive to resolve it for ourselves. So let us logically explore an approach to this fundamental yet seldom asked question: why am I even here? The first logical question in the approach to this subject is, if there is some definite appointed work to accomplish in life at all, does life have a purpose at all? Let us consider the following. Even our material scientists have meticulously cataloged life on our biosphere in every department, and yet have only scratched the surface. By their own estimates, there are around 8.7 million species of plants and animals in existence, but only about 1.2 million have so far been identified and described. Yet, this is just the visible phenomenal nature on Earth. We know that there are many hierarchies of invisible beings both below and above the sublunary region that work behind the scenes to support visible nature. But even in the shallow exploration of tangible nature, science has discovered that every element of the biosphere, both living and non-living, has a critical role to play in supporting planetary life as we know it. This life is the emergent outcome of the complex interactions between species, wherein the whole is unspeakably greater than the sum of its parts. Hence, reductionism, which only looks at a system as the sum of its parts, is incompatible with this living reality. Because from the smallest bacterium to the pinnacle of creation, man, are all inextricably interconnected in the web of life. Nothing can be considered in isolation. In this great economy of nature, there is not one organism that exists which does not serve the larger purpose of life in some way. What then should be said of man, the crown jewel of evolution on earth? It would be humbug of the highest order to attribute no purpose to his life. Okay, once we admit that there must be a purpose to the human condition, the next logical question that arises is, who appointed this work for me? This is a very important question because the ideological basis of the answer to this question accounts for all the difference between the actions of a sage and that of a mass murderer. Some of the most heinous crimes against humanity have been committed by men convinced they were executing the work appointed to them by their exclusive God. The mental abomination that accepts a supranatural God who goads his followers to violence through his ecclesiastical order has been the bane of humanity through all ages. So here again, we see that the ennobling twin doctrine of karma and reincarnation alone hold out a solution to this question that would elevate rather than debase mankind. This doctrine teaches that the real man is not his personality, but on this plane is rather the victim thereof. That which in man is changeless and yet is the substratum of all changes. That which does not act, but is the witness of all action. That which is immortal and yet incessantly incarnates. This is the real self, the soul of man. That which is changeless and undying is necessarily infinite. And that which is infinite is necessarily one. For there cannot be many infinities, for each infinity would subsume every other. There can only be one infinity. This establishes the fundamental identity of all souls with the universal oversoul, its pilgrimage where from, and its ultimate goal where to. And throughout this journey, the soul is guided and checked by the law of karma, which brings to each incarnation its destiny based on the accumulated actions of its past lives. The soul of man is one and hence not separate from the law of karma. The soul is not subject to the law, but rather embodies the law itself. So, who chooses the conditions into which we are born and the duties that are demanded thereof? By this doctrine, the answer is simple. We ourselves choose it in two ways. The many lower personalities, the many incarnations, unknowingly and unconsciously make their own destiny as a natural consequence of their actions. That is one way of choosing. While the higher self, which is the embodiment of the law itself, consciously chooses the conditions of its birth in every incarnation as an expression of the law of harmony. When William Q. Judge advised us to look at any circumstance, no matter how distasteful as the very thing we ourselves deserved and desired, he spoke a profound truth. Ultimately, there is no God that destined any circumstance nor appointed any work for us but ourselves. Consequently, we are answerable to no one but our own divine self that finds expression in the still small voice and the law that it embodies. Okay, so we have said that there must be purpose to life, and that whatever appointed work that we have appointed ourselves. The next logical question is, why have we appointed this work for ourselves? The ultimate purpose of all life is perfection. We see this even in nature. As nature evinces a progressive march towards a higher life, the twin laws of karma and reincarnation aid the ego in achieving that purpose throughout the period of manifestation or manvantara. In each life, we ourselves choose the circumstances and attendant work required to garner the right experiences that bring about an opportunity to counteract and eliminate defects. It is only through lived experience and constant struggle that defects can be counteracted and lessons of life be indelibly impressed upon the soul. As the voice of the silence says, out of the furnace of man's life and its black smoke, winged flames arise, flames purified that soaring onward meet the karmic eye, weave in the end the fabric glorified of the three vestures of the path. Now, we have appointed this work. We know it is appointed for contracting defects, garnering experiences. The next logical question to ask is, if I appointed this work myself for a very clear purpose, why don't I recollect this work that I've appointed for myself? One might even ask, wouldn't it be better if we all came into this world with a roadmap of what to do and when? Well, our real self does come into this world with a clarity of purpose. But from the moment the soul wakes up in the body, it is deluded. The vehicle that the soul inhabits has only faculties that can cognize objects from the five senses. And all higher faculties are dormant due to habitual neglect through many incarnations. There, however, was a time in the latter part of the third root race, immediately following the lighting up of the manas, when men were as gods on earth. But as spirit invested itself deeper and deeper into matter, the principle of karma started to develop and assert itself, the personality gaining the upper hand, and the resultant great dire heresy of separation caused the egos to sin against their own higher nature and thus progressively atrophy their higher faculties. The development of the karmic principle, however, and the ensuing earthly personality is a necessary part of the cycle of involution and evolution. The fourth principle, as a pivot, is necessary for spirit to find expression, no matter how feebly, in the physical form of man. A very pregnant Platonic analogy can help illustrate this point. The element of air, of gaseous nature, cannot directly come in contact with and inhale in the element of earth, of solid nature, or vice versa. It needs the liquid middle element of water, which when cooled, becomes solid, ice, that partakes of the nature of earth. And when heated, becomes gaseous, vapor, which partakes of the nature of air. As such, to bring together and bridge two elements of dissimilar nature, a third element is needed of an intermediate quality that can partake of the nature of both. This is our fourth and fifth principle. They are the pivot around which the whole seven principles of man is cemented together. It is necessary. Regardless, the man of today, as we find ourselves, is still heir to that higher state from which he has fallen. By subjugating the lower personality and making it porous to the influence of the higher, he can even in this life be guided by his divine self. As the voice of the silence says, before the soul can comprehend and may remember, she must unto the silent speaker be united, just as the form to which the clay is modeled is first united with the potter's mind. Okay, we will say at this juncture, if I don't remember, how will I know? And if I don't know, how can I act? You don't need to know. You don't need to first remember in order to know and act. You only need to have faith in the law. Because as Krishna says in the fourth chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, Ajnyascha Shraddha Dhanascha Samshayatma Vinashyati. The ignorant, those full of doubt and without faith, are lost. Faith in the law is not blind faith, but reasoned faith. A sober analysis from the long arc of human history to that of an individual's life, when seen in the light of the doctrine of karma and reincarnation, will show it to be the key that most efficaciously unlocks every riddle of life. As the student faithfully applies this doctrine in daily life, the law proves itself in its universal applicability. Then it is no longer an intellectual exercise or an article of faith, because it becomes a living reality. At that point, the student approaches every situation, no matter how difficult, as the very thing he himself desired. Then the appointed work in one's life becomes absolutely clear. It is the performance of every duty, no matter how small or insignificant, demanded by the situation and station in life that you find yourself in. This may seem like a platitude that we hear everywhere, but it is not an easy endeavor. It is soul work, and the effort must be kept up. As Judge advises us in the letters that have helped me, you can solidify your character by attending to small things, by attacking small faults, and on every small occasion, one by one. This will arouse the inner attitude of attention and caution. The small faults and small occasions being conquered, the character grows strong. Feelings and desires are not wholly of the body. If the mind is deliberately taken off such subjects and placed on other and better ones, then the whole body will follow the mind and grow tractable. The struggle must be kept up, and after a while, it will be easier. End quote. Ironically, attending to the nagging duties of daily life is easier for those that are sincere but have not yet heard the higher calling. The worldly duties weigh more heavily on the shoulders of those looking to work themselves out of such concerns. A student writing for The Path, edited by William Q. Judge, declared the following. I have no desire for any other line of life. But by the time I had awakened to a knowledge of this life, I found myself involved by circumstances against which I do not rebel and out of and through which I'm determined to work, neglecting no known duty to others. Our appointed work in life begins with the performance of duty with the right attitude. But it does not end there. To best illustrate this point, let us begin with one of the key foundations of Western psychology. It's called the Maslow's hierarchy of needs. Now, there are many renditions of this hierarchy, but in its most simplest form, it is essentially a pyramid with three levels. At the lowest level, everybody has these needs, which are psychological needs, food, warmth, rest. These we can call the basic needs. The lowest level. One level higher is what are called psychological needs. You can think of things like belongingness, relationships, friends, prestige, feeling of accomplishment. And the level above that, the last level, the highest, are self-fulfillment needs. In this doctrine, they call it self-actualization. So there are basic needs, psychological needs, self-fulfillment needs. Fewer people have needs at higher levels, it is said, and hence it is a pyramid. Tapers to the top. People in each level aspire for needs at the next level. As such, incentive structures in corporations are largely based on this model. It bears mentioning at this juncture that self-actualization in this model is actually the selfish material culmination of all the potential of the lower personality in the sense that Ayn Rand would attribute to the term. It is a pernicious doctrine, but one that is central to Western thought. Now, if one looks at these needs in isolation, it is a very self-centered view. You know, I put on blinders and say, what do I need? And I find this hierarchy. Because when we zoom out, I take out the blinders and leave my self-centered view and look at it more holistically, it is clear that what is one's need is another's responsibility. For example, a child's need is the parent's responsibility. As such, there is responsibility at the other end of every need. It is the other side of the coin, the other side of the ledger, which needs to be balanced. So just as we have needs, we also must have commensurate responsibilities. And just as there is a hierarchy of needs, there should also be a corresponding hierarchy of responsibilities. If we were to think about this, we may formulate it as such. At the lowest level of responsibility, it is what we have talked about so far. Fulfillment of duties, small and large, demanded by the situation and station in life, executed with a mental attitude of acceptance and cheerfulness. The right mental attitude and fulfillment of the obligatory duties of the situation and station in life that we find ourselves in. Small and large could be the smallest duty, but it is duty nonetheless. That is the first level, we could say. The next level to that are duties to man and beast that are societally considered non-obligatory, but those that are done with no expectation of personal gain or preferred outcome. This we can designate is karma yoga, as delineated in the Bhagavad Gita. This may be considered non-obligatory society by the society. And so one may entertain while, you know, fulfilling these duties, one may entertain expectations of personal gain or preferred outcome. And to do it without that makes it nishkama karma, as talked about in the karma yoga part of Bhagavad Gita. We'll talk about that as the second level of responsibilities. The highest level, we can designate this as self-sacrifice. To give up all sense of personality and sacrifice oneself to the eternal. But as HPB says in her article, esoterically, there is no other way of sacrificing oneself to the eternal than by serving the collective spirit of life embodied in humanity. So self-sacrifice for the sake of humanity, that is the highest level. These three would form the hierarchy of responsibilities. At each higher level, you're not voluntarily taking on more duties. That would be a wrong assumption. But rather, we are waking up to the realization of our own greater responsibility. But to reach for higher responsibilities while being in dereliction of even the smallest of our worldly duties would be to sin against the law. Hence, we should diligently execute through the appointed work at each level before reaching for the next. In essence, our appointed work in life is a series of ever-increasing responsibilities corresponding to the ever-increasing sense of self, culminating in the annihilation of the personal self and the realization of all self. Judge tells us that we have karmic propensities of three kinds. Individual, one. Filial, those associated with family line, two. And national, three. These propensities or skandhas are defects that need to be worked through. Not just as the ego in the individual, but in association with the filial family lines and national lines. But one should recognize that just as no ego can outstrip general humanity in its development, so also, no ego can elevate itself beyond filial karmic tendencies without first elevating the family line along with it. When the ego finds itself entangled in family life, the law of karma has placed it there to eliminate certain defects that come to the ego through its filial skandhas. It is the appointed work of the ego to overcome those defects and consequently raise the family line ever so slightly. The fruit of such efforts in successive incarnations within the same bloodline finally culminates in the ego being able to surmount the residual filial skandhas before marital age and take on a brahmacharya life and be free from family defects. So it is not that a true brahmachari has abandoned his duties towards his family, but that he has fully discharged them by elevating his entire bloodline to the point where he is no longer bound by it. We find this in the life of Gautama Buddha, the lion of the law, after having crossed to the other shore, to the very threshold of nirvana, and returning back with a solution to life's woes and miseries. He eventually turned his footsteps towards Kapilavastu to instruct and uplift his family life. He then traveled the length and breadth of the nation of his day, instructing and elevating a whole generation and many to come after. Then, as the voice says, quote, he preached on mountain plain and held discourses in the cities to devas, men, and gods. As HPP says in the key, theosophy is the quintessence of duty. Unquote. And duty is the debt or runa under which each of us is born. A debt, if left unpaid, leaves us spiritually insolvent and hence morally bankrupt in our next incarnation. So the appointed work in life is to fulfill our duty for duty's sake, to drink from the cup of life to its last dregs. But our appointed work does not stop at fulfilling prescribed duties. As HPP says in the key, further, quote, in every conceivable case, he himself must be a center of spiritual action, and from him and his own daily individual life must radiate those higher spiritual forces which alone can regenerate his fellow men. So in conclusion, there is purpose to human life, as there is purposefulness in nature. The work we take up for each life, we appoint for ourselves, with the goal to eliminate defects in our journey towards perfection. But not just for ourselves, that would be spiritual selfishness, but for the stream of life with which we are associated, starting from our family line, nation, and finally the whole of humanity. As HPP has it, each for all and all for each.